Hello, and welcome to Long Time No See, the podcast. Each week, we'll be pairing two blindfolded comedians who've agreed to sit down with a mystery guest. I'll be putting them on the spot with a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Without further ado, please remove your blindfolds and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Michael.
Hi, Andrea.
I have to be honest with you, I am so relieved to see it's you.
Do you have any irrational fears? What's the worst fad you were into? Is there any job that you would be terrible at?
Underwater welder?
Don't say that about yourself.
Do you guys have any useless talents?
I kicked one of those delivery robots.
What? You kicked one?
Yelling. I kick those all the time.
They have names on them.
Good.
I can make smoke come out of my mouth with nothing.
Do it.
You want to see it?
What the f***? Are you a dragon?
Out now, Long Time No See the Podcast, Season 2. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a UnitedHealthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
Consequence Podcast Network. This is In Defense of Ska. Our mission is to document the ska scene from its traditional roots through until its emergence as a diverse global genre. The influence of ska resonates through your favorite bands and artists in ways you might have missed. I'm your co-host, Adam D. of Omnigon and Asian Man Records band, Link 80. Joining me is your host, Aaron Carnes, renowned author of the book In Defense of Ska, which is currently available in an expanded second edition.
We're going back to the 80s today, and we're going to talk about a band that was instrumental in the global trad ska revival. I'm talking about Potato 5.
Potato 5.
So Potato 5 starts just after Two Tone in England. So let's go back to Two Tone and think about how popular the music was, how quickly it died out, and how the music wasn't really it had no intention to be traditional in its approach to ska and reggae. It was like intentionally punk rock mixed with Jamaican music. This is what Two Tone was.
Yeah.
So there really wasn't like a revival of old ska at this point. So Potato 5 begins in 1983. And at this point, ska is like, England has moved on to other music. Mm-hmm. The band they play, they go till 1989. They started out as an instrumental group, but they would eventually work with a few different vocalists. There was Floyd Lloyd, Spider Johnson, and the one and only Laurel Aitken, i.e. the godfather of ska. So the group have been playing together again in recent years. So we were able to talk to four members that were in the band in the 80s about the history and the importance that they had towards this movement of ska in the 80s.
Well, let's go talk to Potato 5 right now.
So I'm Richard Walker, otherwise known as Rick. I play tenor saxophone in the band, started on alto actually, way back. And I joined probably after Andy and certainly after Simon. So I was playing in the 80s. And that's enough
from
to
the
get
80s,
going
yeah.
from the 80s onwards.
Hi, I'm Simon. And I was the first one in the band with my friend Martin. And that's how we started back in 83 or 4.
Right. I'm Andy Minion. And I joined the band soon after it got going. Playing alto saxophone.
Okay, yeah. I'm Malcolm Buck, and I joined just after these guys as part of the horn section. So we are the horn section. I play tenor sax all the way through.
Yeah. So you're two tenors, a trombone and an alto, and that's the Potato 5 horn section.
So before we get into the history of the band, I just want to ask, you guys have reformed and are still playing as of when? 2022?
Well, gosh, that's a good question.
No, it's 2018.
2018, okay.
Where we joined Maroon Town and the horn section, us four, joined with Maroon Town to play with them. And then we had a good time. And then the rest of the people, we got the rest of them together. So it's just a horn section originally that reformed for the London Ska Festival, which is on at the moment. We did that in 2018.
And I think it was an anniversary year for them. I think it might have been 30 years after they did the first one in Camden or Finsbury Park.
How was that first show back?
It was great.
Yeah,
it was good. It was good to do it. And, well, we always enjoyed playing together, so it was nice. And Maroon Town, it was lovely to play with them because Maroon Town had come along slightly after we'd started and were, in a way, certainly enjoyed seeing us and kind of hearing what we were doing. So they were very flattering about how much we'd played a part in getting that band together. And they're a really good band. So all the people in Maroon Town really know their onions.
So I want to talk about the formation of the band in 1983, correct?
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit about what was happening in England in 1983 musically and why you decided to start this band, a ska band, kind of after Two Tone had basically come and gone and people had kind of moved on to other stuff?
Yes, exactly that. People had moved on. But I was in a band with Martin. We were doing different kind of music. Have you heard of Pig Bag?
No.
Oh, really? Pig Bag is kind of brass orientated, a bit funky.
Punk, really.
Yeah, and we used to do songs like that. It was a bit of a ramshackle band. And then we stuck in a few ska songs and realised that people liked them more. People were dancing more. People were more energetic. And then I remember having a meeting once and we just went like, sod it, let's just do all ska. And that's when we switched from being a pig baggy band to a ska band. And that's how it started.
Yeah.
And,
but weren't you guys, Devotee? I mean, you collected a lot of that kind of music anyway. You knew it backwards, didn't you?
Well, no, Martin was more of a fan of reggae because his brother.
Okay.
Yeah, Martin's
brother used to go to school with, I don't know if you had Honest John Records. And so they had access to all the old records. And so Martin would come along and make his tape of brilliant records, and he'd go like, oh, wow, you know, great.
Yeah.
Because in those days you couldn't really hear it that much. I mean, I was a massive Two-Tone fan, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But the old stuff, some people say you could get to hear it, but in my situation you couldn't really. You couldn't really buy it. It wasn't on the radio. It was just not around, really, until you meet Martin. He's got all the records.
And Martin, Martin's brother Neil, was in Leeds at uni. He collected a load of stuff up there of Jamaican singles.
Yeah.
His elder brother.
It's interesting that, isn't it? Because, I mean, nowadays you just put Scatterlights or Bobby Ellis and the Crystalites into whatever it is, into YouTube, and you've got it there. Or Spotify even, you know, all of those kind of things. But in those days, you had to go out and buy records, and you had to buy records from secondhand markets or shops like Honest John or Peckins.
For me, going to Peckins was the real beginning of just really getting immersed in the original Scarner Studio One stuff, you know. That was a shop in Shepherd's Bush run by, you know, a Jamaican family who still running, but they were the single kind of importer of Studio One, weren't they?
Yeah, it was a relative of Coxon.
Relative.
He set up a shop in Acton.
And you just go up there and they had a big speaker. They played the 7s and they played the 12 inches and they played the albums and you just piled them up and went out.
And if you wanted to go
get to
buy some records, you first have to go to the betting shop next door.
That's what I was going to say. You don't get to hear any records because he wouldn't be in there. In a betting shop. You'd be in a betting shop, you'd have to go look around and go, all right, we come to buy some records. You'd go, okay then. And then open up the shop and then stick on the most incredible Studio One records. Yeah. There's really loud speakers. It was a fantastic, well, it's still going, I think. It's still a fantastic shop.
And nothing was in sleeves. It's all, you know, in white sleeves. So if you were going in there, you'd have to know who you were wanted to listen to. So, you know, you couldn't just go and browse, really. You'd say, have you got anything by Tommy McCook? And he'd say, yeah, put something incredible on. So, yeah, you couldn't just go in and sort of flip through the records.
So when Two-Tone was really big in England in like 79, 80, how much would you say that audience understood about Scottalites and original Jamaican ska and stuff like that?
Oh, I think, the one person I know really well from that period is Jerry Dammers, and Jerry Dammers still DJs, and Jerry Dammers' collection is massive. Mm-hmm. I mean, he knew the records back, but I mean, you know, there were other things he was listening to, but I mean, I think there was some people in that era of bands who were familiar with that music and reggae more broadly, because, you know, a lot of things that had happened in the 70s, you know, there was Misty and Roots, there was a lot of reggae bands around, but it wasn't necessarily ska.
And then
you know, there was also people coming from the more punk side of things, you know, that influenced that Two-Tone stuff. So it wasn't like everybody would have had that comprehensive knowledge, but I think a lot of people of our generation, our parents had records. You know, there was stuff in the background that if you dug about, you would find things. I mean, I remember probably one of the first records I listened to was in my dad's record collection, which was The Israelites by Jimmy Cliff, you know. So
Desmond
it was
Dick.
Sorry, Desmond Decker even, yeah.
Not the Jimmy Cliff.
Not the Jimmy
Man, Cliff. I was like, Jimmy Cliff did a version?
I'm obviously needing some dinner, but there you go. But that's
a good question, though. But yeah. I think Jerry Dammers was the key, is what we're saying.
Sure.
So when you guys decided to start a ska band, basically, it was more consciously focused on the older stuff and not sounding like Two-Tone.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there was no Two-Tone influence on us. It was one of the first songs we did, because I'd got the trombone, we're doing Man in the Street, and that was the one that got people going. And it's probably that record that made us into a ska band, actually, because we covered it in our first practices. And yeah, Two-Tone, we didn't really give that much of a thought.
And it was an instrumental band as well, wasn't it?
Oh, so yeah, they're right. Instrumental, yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a singer for quite a while, a good year or two.
Mm-hmm. And when we did get a singer, we found a guy from the Alpha Boys School in Floyd Lloyd when he was our first singer. And so he was pure pedigree Jamaican, you know, who'd gone to the Alpha Boys School back in Jamaica. And yeah, he seemed really authentic, and he certainly had the voice, you know. Mm. Yeah. So then we were still looking backwards, you know, as we put the band together. And then, of course, Laurel Aitken joined us. So that, you know, that was a real delight, given that we were so mad for the old stuff.
And that was quite formative, wasn't it? Because we got to know, I don't know, did Marty get to know Laurel Aitken at the secondary? But we got to know him through Gaz, didn't we?
No, he was at the gig at the Dingwalls.
Okay.
And then he was backstage, and then I remember his face to this day, he was just looking over and he was smiling he was loving it. He was going like, wow, he thought it was fantastic. And he said, I've got to come and sing for you. He's going, it was amazing, really.
Love at first sight.
Yeah, it was with Laurel. He was
it was great. Sure.
He was a little taken back or a little surprised to hear you guys playing the old sound.
Yeah.
That was it.
Definitely.
There was an interview with him from a German fanzine in which he was asked, did you ever kind of really get equal experience of playing with being with bands like Scatterlights? And he said, there was one band. And that was his, I love that quote. I've lost it since, but believe me, He once said that, and that was potato fire for him, because we had that horn. We had the horn sound that he remembered from back in the day.
Before Floyd and Laurel Aiken joined the band, when you guys were just an instrumental ska band, how were audiences reacting to you? Were they enjoying it, or were they? Was it a little unsure? You know, because other things were popular at the time.
I'll tell you what was amazing is we used to play in a residency in a pub in Brixton. It was literally nobody would have heard of us. We'd only just started going. And then it just, people would just start dancing in the pub. It was great. It was, that's the great thing about ska, I guess, isn't it?
It's the dance.
Imagine being in an indie band and you start playing and everybody's staring at you and you don't know. But when you're in a ska band, a bit unexpectedly good sound in a pub in Brixton, they all... It's always a good reaction.
No, we it was really cheering. Whenever we played, just that upbeat, that and offbeat, I should say, really.
Yeah, it's the offbeat, yeah, isn't it? It's everybody. Offbeat.
And everyone cheeks, and it's happy, isn't it?
Do you remember that we did a gig for the GLC, which is Greater London Council, in a park on the River Thames? And it was kind of a lot of old people, a lot of old black people who were there, and they all... got up and I remember all dancing away and it was kind of like, wow, that was, that, do you remember that gig?
Yeah, yeah.
That was great, wasn't it, that one?
Yeah, and another thing I remember was, we, you know, which is a similar thing, which we didn't expect. Well, we went up to, this dates us because there was a huge, there was a miners' strike in 1984, I think. Yeah. And... a lot of people in London supported the miners. A lot of people from all over the country did, but it was an extremely divisive thing in the UK. It's Margaret Thatcher, blah, blah, blah. So the miners were striking for their jobs. And we went up as part of a miners' support group to a mine in Sheffield, nearby, anyway, called Kiverton Park. And to be honest, I thought those guys... we're just going to think, what the hell is this? But we went down like a bomb, didn't we? And everybody was dancing. I mean, it was fantastic. It was really moving to see that.
It was unexpected. Some gigs you think, like, oh, God, this is going to be terrible. Socialist Worker Party in Skegness. Remember that one?
God, yeah.
Oh, my God. And then they all end up on the stage. Yeah. They're all wearing...
Well, they used to say about them, what socialists, what workers? And they'd say, yeah, but we know how to party. Socialist Worker Party joke. Bit obscure.
In 83, 84, in the very early years, were there any other bands in England playing ska at that point?
No. Not many.
There were none.
But then we wouldn't have known that probably somebody might watch us and go, yeah, we were doing that. We were bloody 82. I mean, Bad Manners was still going, and
That's true. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And then, well, Bad Manners didn't want to play. I better not say it. So they didn't want to play very much. So Buster then formed his other band, which is Buster's All Stars. So that was keeping it going around the same time as well.
Yeah,
which was people like me or other people were playing with him.
But other than that, there weren't many bands or anything,
were there? And then describe what we did. We rehearsed in a basement for months every week. And then Andy here was in the social services type scene and got us loads of community gigs and benefits and stuff like that. And that's how we honed our skills.
Yeah, we played
an awful lot.
Just East London community events, you know, with me. I had a Morris Traveller and I used to bring the entire PA drum kit to every gig. But the thing was about it, like Simon says, is that whichever the audience was there, everyone loved it. Everyone really stepped up to
And comedy gigs, do you remember?
Yeah, we used to
do a lot of... At the end of a comedy night, they'd bring a band on and that'd be us. And by that stage, they're all completely pissed, obviously. So,
I would say I'll share a link. I don't know if you've seen it, of us playing in a kind of really deserted street party.
Yeah, that's not a good example.
In the East End.
Everybody's gone home.
As an instrumental band, at the end, the camera pans round and everyone's gone. We're, we're all going, chicka, you know, really working hard at the scar. So that was where we cut our teeth, really.
I think the other thing that I would say is, that, and I might be mixing, it's difficult when you go back this far, really, because of what we're talking about over 30 years ago, but there was a point where we overlapped with what was a really vibrant music scene in terms of live music at the time, which was in pubs, mainly in pubs, but there were also some slightly bigger venues. So, I mean, the Pogues were still big. There were bands like The Men They Couldn't Hang. There was people playing different kind of genres of music to us. So, you know, country, swing, rockabilly, well, country swing I meant really, but, you know, there were all sorts of different styles of music, but it was live, and that was what people really liked, because, you know, things that were in the charts were much more synthetic and you know, overproduced and so on. So there was lots of venues, and I mean, one first place we played with Laurel was the Cricketers in London, which is a little pub that had live music, and we used to sell out places like that, and it was fantastic because you had that kind of following, and that's the way that we built up, apart from the stuff that Malcolm was talking about, the Andy Arrange. So, but lots of different kind of styles of music, I'd say, but it was a very vibrant scene.
In terms of what you're talking about, like what was on the charts at the time, we're talking about like Duran Duran, Culture Club, that kind of stuff, right? That's kind of what was pop music at the time.
Yeah, Wham. I mean, you know, you know, not to knock all of that stuff. I mean, you know, a lot of it was very good music. But I mean, I think, you know, on the ground, so to speak, away from what was happening on the TV and so on, or not, and you know, we can begin to get MTV and all that kind of stuff. But there was the people after punk in Britain. People wanted to see actual bands.
Live bands, yeah. It was a good, there was a strong scene,
Well, Duran had a hit called Rio, didn't they? And they went and filmed a video out on a ship somewhere, obviously somewhere in Brazil. And then we were about to get signed by CBS Sony. And I was trying to call one of our instrumental songs to call it The Maldives in case they want to make a video.
No, that song. What a brilliant manoeuvre.
The other song I wanted to make for you, Beer's Got to Be Free by 1983.
It never happened.
Because instrumental songs, you can call them whatever you want, obviously. Yeah. The Maldives.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
So what's the story behind a CBS signing?
Well, I think that was Gaz, wasn't it? I mean, we had...
You know the story, don't you?
Yeah, go for it.
Well, it's just connections in Japan because of Gaz. So we've kind of skipped a bit if we were doing these gigs around London, just instrumental, but then bumped into Gaz, so he became a manager.
Gaz Mayall is the person,
Gaz is Rocking Blues, which is a small club in London. They set up a label... Well, basically for us, because we released our first... His first records were our records.
And they were our first records, apart from, the thing we did with Mad Professor.
Yeah,
and he got those connections in Japan. He goes there a lot, Gaz. Yeah. And then somehow that worked into CBS Sony.
And that linked with Stiff Records.
Well, it was later, wasn't it, after CBS?
Was it later?
God. Was it after? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, CBS Sony was the first album.
Oh, I see. So, but those first few records that Gaz released, like you did a record with Floyd, you did one with Laurel, you did one with the Mad Professor. These are all kind of at the same time, right?
Yeah. Mad Professor was probably the first thing that we recorded. It's interesting. When Mad Professor heard what we were doing, he said, you know, Nick, that we were talking about people recognizing that kind of music. He said, oh, yeah, old school style tunes.
You know, old-time music.
Old-time music, exactly. You know, it was just like not what, you know, what he
we
was
just
doing.
We knew where his studio was. And so who was it? Was it you? Malcolm knocked on his door.
I was working down the road. Yeah.
So we asked if we could come and do a couple of days recording.
But I mean, for people who are unfamiliar, the Mad Professor is like a dub engineer, right?
Yeah. Work with loads of people.
I thought it would be interesting personally to hear Al Scar music with his touch on it. And I knew I just worked in the next street, and I knew where he worked from, and he had his studio there. So I just knocked on the door one day and said, "I'm in a ska band," and he probably thought I was nuts. But he said, "Yeah, 'cause, you know, pay me so much a day, I can't remember, but
200 quid the whole thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. And we had a great time. But the most amazing thing about that was I took in a boogie box that had a record button on it. And it was crazy because everything he recorded, he'd play it back and he'd dub it. Like, as it was playing back, he'd do all this mad stuff. Yeah. Do you remember it? Yeah. All the wild geese noises and all this shit.
And alarms going.
Yeah. And I had it all recorded and I lost the freaking tape. Oh, it was nice. Brilliant.
Oh. There was
so much stuff on it.
Yeah, the session.
Yeah.
But that's a classic little 445 record that we released on our own private label.
It had Martin's
called Droll Tone.
Yeah.
Droll Tone label.
With a certain degree of irony, that's what you say.
Yeah, so that was a really nice first experience. But it was,
and it featured another of our vocalists that only performed once with us, which was Martin's father,
dad, yeah.
Named Scar Danger.
Scar Danger.
The thing about vocalists was, I mean, it did get to a point where we played a lot live and it was, you know, people were dancing, it was great fun, but there was this kind of feeling that we were getting, because in those days, bands signed for labels. It was, you know, you didn't do it all yourself. And, you know, people weren't really interested unless you were doing vocal stuff.
You explained, you told the story how you met Laurel. How did you meet Floyd? Can you kind of tell that story too?
He came to one of these community gigs we were doing. I think we were in Victoria Park.
Yeah.
In East
it was London. It was a big do in Victoria Park in near Hackney. And there were loads of different bands on. And, he just saw us playing. We'd seen him playing. I think he was playing to tapes.
He was,
I remember him doing Van Morrison's,
Moondance.
Moondance, yeah. Because he, you know, like Floyd was... Really, I imagine Floyd as a hippie, you know, real hippie kind of feel, vibe about him. Really lovely guy. And that was, you know, you could tell it was perfect for him, like Moondance, you know.
We never let him do that with
No.
So we had straight to into a Van Morrison cover. So
keep him under control with the
But he recognised the sound. And
he
when the first practice he came down to, just to give it a go. And he opened his mouth and he just had the, you know, it was a bit Horace Andy, it was a bit Johnny Osborne, you know, he sounded like the real deal. Yeah. And we were delighted, you know, and he had a few tunes. He'd recorded some stuff with Trojan.
Yeah.
And on his own label, Tropic, he did his stuff. But he, our job was to keep him being old school, old time and authentic,
yeah.
And to stop him drifting over to, you know, doing a Van Morrison.
Back to the hippie days, yeah.
But that went well.
And our favourite, I think our favourite one of his is Babylon Shall Fall. It's a really good driving
rebel,
ska tune.
Rebel
and
song.
It's a rebel song, you know. It's, it's kind of a little bit out of the mould of Floyd, but it's his tune and it's great.
Yeah.
You can YouTube it.
Yeah, I really like the song Tear Up or Tear It Up.
But that's actually you know, the thing about Tear Up is it's interesting that the origin of that, because you know, that's a Mongo Santa Maria tune, or at least
Cuban.
Yeah, so you know, the Scatolites did a lot of covers that were more. I mean, Watermelon Man, which the that's not a Mongo Santa Maria tune, but it's a tune obviously by Herbie Hancock, but Mongo Santa Maria covered it. But they did, you know, a whole host of...
They did loads of them.
Host the things, yeah. And if you look back...
Converted it to ska.
Yeah, exactly. So that was an instrumental, but Floyd, when we recorded it, put some vocals on it, yeah.
It's my understanding that there was a an anti-apartheid message related to that song.
Yeah.
He put those lyrics on top, and the thing, you know, I mentioned Jerry Dammers earlier on, but yeah. I mentioned the Miners, and the thing, one of the things that when I started getting into music, I was getting into the idea of putting on benefits for various different people, and through that I forged a connection with Jerry Dammers, who we met at an anti-apartheid benefit in Sheffield. I think it was the first time we met him, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Probably, yeah.
And you helped set up this Artists Against Apartheid organisation that then was we were very much part of, and that song for Floyd, that was his politics. It was the band's politics. Yeah. So we brought those lyrics forward for Terror.
That was contemporary to that point. And we did a benefit in Fridge, which, do you remember that?
We ended up doing a lot, didn't we, for AA?
That was the first.
Played with Madness for an AA gig.
Yeah, we did.
At Brixton.
AAA. Artists
Against Apartheid was the organisation.
Gil Scott Heron was on that.
Yeah. Madness and the Potato Farm.
And we all ended up on the stage together. It was amazing.
So that was important. Politics, and I mean that link, I suppose, with the previous generation of the two-tone, and politics was always important for those artists. So that was the key thing. Well, one of the things that I think that the two-tone musicians, the Specials, Madness, all of those people had to confront was, they were obviously mixed bands. They were promoting a particular kind of political attitude with what they did. But, there was always an issue with people getting attracted to that music from the opposite end of the political spectrum, and that was always an issue. So, it was good to make put that message over that, we were a band that was a mixed band, and we were against all of
those. We'd done loads of rock against racism before that.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's what we grew up with as well. I mean, I can remember going to the rock against racism thing before Two Tone, even in the 70s, was a massive thing where, people, the punk bands like The Clash and Misty and Roots, the reggae bands, were all on the same bill. So that was a huge thing growing up in the 70s, that kind of struggle against extreme right-wing groups in this country.
Now, when Jerry Dammers with the Specials, a.k.a. did Free Nelson Mandela, that song, to my understanding, helped kind of raise awareness about, like, the actual situation going on with apartheid and Nelson Mandela in a bigger global sense. But when you guys were doing these benefits and you're doing Tear Up, was there a growing movement in England to end apartheid, or was it a lesser known thing, or what was kind of the state of it?
Well, I think it grew.
It was massive.
It was very strong, really strong anti-apartheid movement based in London. With a continuous picket of the South African embassy, which is right next to Trafalgar Square. Mm. So it's a real central kind of gathering point for activists. There were a lot of marches. There was a lot of kind of arrests on marches and that we were kind of fringe involved with, and did benefits for, the apartheid, wider anti-apartheid movement. It was, it was a big thing. But it kind of wove in, as Rick said earlier, with this, the 80s and the kind of fight with the Miners and against Thatcher, that the Specials were obviously right at the heart of with their message,
Yeah, it's a good point, Andy, because the anti-apartheid movement in Britain was very big before what we tried to do. And I suppose the specific aim that Jerry Dammers had wanted to do with the Artists Against Apartheid was to put, you know, professional events and campaigning organisational things together with bands who are an artists as well, because it wasn't just music, it was all sorts of different people, but to really raise the profile of that issue. I mean, he had family that had experienced that firsthand in South Africa, so I think it was a big issue. And fortunately, he had connections with some of the people going right up to the ANC at a higher level. So there was a contact with those people. We could get some kind of direct line about what was the best way to approach things. So, yeah, it followed out of a much bigger thing, I think, that was cultural context, wasn't it?
So you did this record with Floyd, and you did this record with Laurel. Were they both kind of playing with it at the same time, or how did that work out?
That's a very pertinent question, isn't it? it was difficult, wasn't it?
It wasn't.
But it didn't work for Floyd, did it? Let's be honest.
There was a good, strong overlap period, and some of our best gigs were done with both of them together. And that was lovely. Push came to shove, and we had opportunity to go to Japan and pursue the stuff with the labels there. And we did it with Laurel. That's where all the momentum was, and we'd fallen in love with Laurel. It was a big thing. And to be fair, Floyd was, he was hard work. You know, he's a difficult guy sometimes, but he was a wonderful bloke, don't get me wrong. But he was also, we did mention earlier that drift towards doing a Van Morrison cover was all there.
Well, I mean, Laurel Aiken is the godfather of ska. I mean, what are you going to do?
I'm sorry, Floyd, yeah.
Yeah, and then Laurel came in and started writing tunes for us, like Sally Brown and Mad About You. He'd never done those before. They were for us. He felt our vibe and wrote them for us.
And all the stuff on our later album with Laurel, he wrote especially for us. So there was a lot of stuff that he only did with us,
Yeah. Now, I have to confess something, and this is something I didn't realize until I was doing the research. I thought Sally Brown was a 60s ska song. I had no idea that he wrote it in the 80s with you guys.
Let me tell you about Sally Brown. Let me tell you about Sally Brown. Sally Brown is a girl in town. Sally Brown is a girl in town. She don't mess around.
No, I did. When he brought it along and introduced it, I thought, oh, this must be an old Laurel Aiken classic, but it was brand spanking new.
In fact, 100% of people that I speak to about Sally Brown say, "Well, I thought it was a Bad Manners song."
Yeah, I knew it wasn't a Bad Manners song originally, but I thought it was just an old ska song. I didn't realize it was how recent it was.
No, he gave us a tape of it, and I remember going down to Malcolm's place, and we all worked out the horn parts.
We wrote the horn line, but then Nick Welsh from Bad Manners and rearranged it for Bad Manners.
Yeah, they did a rearrangement.
They did arrange it.
I did look up Sally Brown once, and there is. I think it's a cultural. There's a that you can probably find a folk tradition in that figure and the cuckoo maca stick as well. So there's stuff that Laurel was drawing on that may be traditional.
Laurel was Cuban. But grew up in Jamaica, so he brought all that stuff with him.
Yeah.
But it just immediately, that song, I know exactly what you mean, it just immediately sounded like a song that's always been there.
Yeah.
And it's a bit of a classic. Yeah.
When did you hear Sally Brown in America for the first time?
I heard it, the first time I heard it was when Bad Manners played it, because it was one of their more popular songs that they in their set.
Mm. Yeah.
But, like all the two-tone bands, that they're playing lots of covers within their sets. So you just kind of know, these are old ska and rock steady songs.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure thing.
Yeah.
It was nice they did it. Buster used to come to all our gigs and used to jump up on stage and sing Sally Brown. And
he almost started us getting lynched, right?
He saved us twice from death.
Yeah, the audience was getting a bit leery. When we,
death by a skinhead.
We're moving beyond the kind of the community.
No, we want to hear that story.
Yeah, we want to hear the story.
Now we're doing bigger gigs and then sometimes not going down so well.
Doncaster Racecourse.
Now, we're talking about the politics of skinheads and whatever was going on. When we get to Doncaster.
It's a scooter rally.
We're
driving through the crowd and I didn't see it, but somebody said, when the skinheads went like that, so Floyd.
Oh, God.
It's kind of, oh, my God. I don't know if you ever heard what happened to Desmond Decker. He was playing on the same bill. But a year before, he was doing a scooter rally at Great Yarmouth. And he got attacked on the stage, got hit in the face with a bottle. And this was his first new gig that he was doing there. And so they were a scary bunch of people, to be honest.
Yeah, they were on scooters doing wheelies with, and they're all got like Nazi tattoos on their heads, their legs, shaved heads, boots up to their knees, you know, DMs. That was a scary, scary sight, you know. And actually what happened with Floyd, I was in the front of the van with Floyd next to me. He was by the window. And so we drove into this hellish scene with people doing wheelies on scooters and tattoos everywhere. And we wound down the window like, where are the dressing rooms? And this skinhead stuck his head through the window. He went, "You've made a fatal mistake coming here today."
And then it turned out to be exactly that. We didn't go down well.
Yes.
And it was a lot of people there, wasn't it? And they were kind of going a little bit mad. And we could tell this is going ugly now. And and then Buster jumped out on stage because they knew him. And then he started singing Sally Brown with us. And everybody went, "Way!" Everybody.
Monkey Man with us.
Yeah.
Yeah, he saved us in a few of those situations in some of the places.
He's a good guy to know, really.
The wrong kind of skinhead.
He also used to come. I remember we did a festival in Cornwall with him. And he turned up, bring his van, and he'd have a great big barrel of beer in it. And he'd set it up. Backstage, he was really the right guy to be backstage with, but also on the front of the stage. On that particular event, the electricity went down. We're trying to play. He rolled out on stage and led the audience in a kind of shouty version of.
Yeah. This is how the Bad Manners version of Sally Brown started, because he had to sing it with us
to save our lives,
and then they took it.
Okay, so that happened before Bad Manners Come.
Oh, yeah.
But they sped it up and they put in some good, you know, the Sally Brown thing. And, you know, they did some good stuff to it. And I was listening to it with my partner recently and we kind of always prefer. No, I can't say that on the interview. It's almost a potato pie version.
No, they did a good job.
I think they did the right arrangement.
Cycling across the Constitution. That was sweet. When you cycled along Camden Lock and heard it playing, and it wasn't playing from a record, it was playing live. Do you remember
that? Yeah, it was a band was playing it in a pub. We had no idea that anybody knew our song, Sally Brown. And then we went for a drink a few years after the band had finished and the band was playing it. And it was kind of, oh, my God, that's our song. They're playing it in a pub.
There are now Sally Brown cafes in different parts and bars in four different major cities across the world, you know, as a result of Laurel writing that song with Potato Five back in the day.
Yeah,
you know?
It's nice to be associated.
And then you look on YouTube, there's like 40 or 50 covers from every corner of the globe, you know. And I really like
that. More than that.
And hopefully a bit of money's trickling back to Laurel Aitken estate, you know.
Yeah. I want to say, like, because Bad Manners covered that song on, was it Return of the Ugly? It was, like, late 80s. I feel like that's probably their best-known late 80s song.
Mm-hmm. But it never got in the charts, did it? There was no, I don't quite know how it turned into this song that all these ska bands cover when it was you know, they've had, haven't they had like five or six top 10 hits, didn't they?
But not with that.
Yeah.
Not with that, no.
We'll be right back after this.
When you guys first met up with Laurel, how was his career doing? Was he struggling or was he still very popular?
No, he was struggling. He lived in Leicester and he was playing a residency in a restaurant, singing in Spanish, Cuban, traditional Cuban songs. He wasn't
with the Pressure Tenants.
I'm not quite sure with the rest of the scene. Yeah, I don't think.
Yeah, I think he might have had a band with whom he went out back. Even when we met him, but it was very low key, very local.
Well, it's a Pressure Tenants.
The Pressure Tenants.
Yeah. No, good band.
But it was.
I think the Pressure Tenants played with him if they were playing up north, but anything down south, he'd come to us.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not at the beginning. Like, you know, Aaron's talking about when he met us. Yeah.
He was on the bill that. Wasn't he?
Yeah, Dingles. Yeah. Yeah, he was doing okay, wasn't he?
So he was getting bookings with his Pressure Tenants band from Leicester, and they'd come down, but he wasn't part of, you know, there wasn't a ska scene yet, you know, and he led, as the Godfather, he led that 80s wave of revival, really, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he definitely had a resurgence in the late 80s and 90s. In terms of like popularity, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. He was such a great performer, you know, with his kind of tinsel wigs and his, you know, shiny suits and jumping up, aged like 60 something.
He was 60 when he joined us, and we couldn't believe like the tinsel wig and jumping around like an 18-year-old. He was just so energetic and into it, you know.
Yeah.
But then you'd sit in the band with him and be like your dad, you know, sitting there like you'd look after him.
Yeah. Simon, get me a brandy.
Oh, yeah. Get me a brandy. It was his catchphrase. Yeah. Make it a double.
The record you guys did in 87, Floyd Lloyd and the Potato Five meets Laurel Aiken, was that a collection of the stuff you'd recorded before, or was it an all-new recording?
Well, it had the core stuff we'd already released on 7-inch with Gaz. So that was on that as a compilation almost. But there were new tracks on that that we hadn't.
So then he added in the Laurel ones, yeah?
Yeah.
And the Laurel stuff was new, yeah.
Yeah, we recorded Floyd Lloyd first and then had another session with Laurel.
That's right.
After this record, you guys did, what's the record called? True Fact. True Fact was the next record. Is this the record that was potentially going to get signed by CBS?
No, CBS did sign. If you can find a copy of the Laurel Aitken thing on CBS Sony.
Laurel Aitken.
First album was released
Five Meet Laurel Aitken.
Yeah, that was released in Japan on CBS.
Oh, it was released on CBS in Japan only?
Yeah, in Japan, not in the UK. So here of in Japanese with Japanese writing on it. And then we went to Japan, and then I don't quite know what happened after that.
We released a 7-inch there in Japan for the tour we did there, which was also featured the Stiff brand because we signed to Stiff at that point. And that was a Western special.
No, Stiff was late. Stiff was after.
It's on the label, it says Stiff.
Oh, right.
Oh,
does it?
Yeah, I'll show you.
Is it Mad About You?
You need to go grab the copy.
Oh, yeah. I thought True Fact was on Stiff, but they didn't release it because they went bust. We broke them.
They signed you, and then they went bust, right?
But they paid for the recording, which was at the Madness Studios in London, and just when it was about to be released, it sort of gone bust. Which is why it's released on a different label, which is our own label, the Racket label.
When you guys, so this Japan tour, how did the tour go? Because you guys had the support of CBS. Was there a lot of people at these shows?
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was only two dates, I think, was it?
It was
Osaka
and three.
Tokyo,
was it only
Osaka.
Three?
Yeah.
I mean, one thing that was nice about that, I mean, you know, again, this international thing was we met a band called the Scar Flames, and they were just, it was like they had the whole thing down. They had a double bass player. They sounded like the original Scatolites.
You know, like Japanese do, they just study everything and get it completely right.
Sorted out. And it was just a joy to play with them.
Yeah, it's a bit embarrassing when you step up in a sound check and you go, meh, 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 and then they start going, bah, bah, bah.
And Laurel was just like blown away by them. Yeah. And that's why he wrote Scar Flames, the tune, on True Facts. Yeah. That was different to them.
That was about them, yeah. No, they're a great band, yeah.
And the other thing, just, you know, I forget all of these things until it comes up, but the other connection back to the specials was we worked on the True Fact albums. Well, I mean, a lot of it was written by Martin and, you know, directed by our drummer Paul Hickson, who sadly died last year. But we worked as a horn section, and he produced the album with Dick Cuthell. And Dick Cuthell was the trumpet player with the specials, who you'll see in those clips. You know, the wonderful moustache and everything. Fantastic musician. And it was great to work with him.
And Dick had worked for Ireland on a lot of production stuff in the in the reggae period in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, Catch a Fire.
Dick Cuthell, look him up. He's just a great, you know, he's just a really important man in reggae.
I think he'd been to Warrico with Rico.
He worked on Rico's albums.
Yeah,
Dick Cuthell's the
guitar.
Is it the cornet?
Trumpet and cornet, yeah. And
Flugelhorn.
Flugelhorn, indeed, yeah.
Anyway, he got us in shape for True Facts. He was a great help to us as a horn section. We learned a lot from him.
So I'm curious about True Fact and the decision to use drum machines.
Martin and Paul.
Well, it's funny that the decision was made by the drummer to use a drum machine. Yeah. But yeah, I think it was all part of that whole thing of, well, we could get signed here. It went a bit kind of music businessy and make it more. And it was the way music was going then. It was more.
Yeah,
where did we? Sizes, electric. Oh, and Martin got bought a Mirage sampler by his dad.
Santa did it.
Yeah.
The one that was singing on Scar Danger, saying, Scar Danger. Do you want a Mirage, son? So.
The other thing is they were really excited about hip hop. You know, they were excited about the early rap with really stripped down 808 drum machines or whatever. You know, all those stripped back stuff. and there was a bit of a scassid thing going on. That scassid kind of thing with Long ZD here in the UK. And a few just individual tunes where people were kind of putting a bit of electronic beats behind ska and bringing it up to date and making dance music again, you know. And we were interested in that, but, you know, and that was our go at it, you know.
I mean, I do think that from the start, Simon, you probably might be able to comment, but the like the ethos of the Potato Five had been like a punky, experimental type ethos. No, we weren't musicians who were brilliant technically. We had passion and the feeling, and we loved the music, and that was it, you know. And this was all part of experimenting and looking around for other influences and things that you loved that you wanted to stick in, you know.
Yeah, and I think there's always a tension between wanting to move forward, look forward, do something new, and be inspired by music from the past, which you love. But it's always a problem if you're doing things within a musical genre. You know, what's the point of just pretending to be the Scatolites or, you know, all of those bands? So, you know, because it's done. They did it so much better than you could ever do. So you have to find somewhere.
Do either of you like True Fact?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do.
Oh, you do?
Mm-hmm. And also Scassid, is that how we pronounce it?
Yeah.
Scassid!
This is a virtually unknown thing in the US, but this was a brief movement in the UK at this time period.
Acid House meets ska.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did the gig at the Town and Country, which is with Long CD and Bad Manners playing or something. It's with Dougie anyway. And that is This Is Ska.
This is Ska. This is Ska.
The sound of Ska.
This is Ska. This is Ska. Ska.
Which then Bad Manners took on and still having their set to the day, don't they?
Yeah, and that's a long CD too.
A long CD.
Yeah,
that was a good night, I remember.
But, you know, that was a rare one because I think our problem was that we were a live band and we, you can tell, up to now, we talked, all of our explanation is how well we went down with this sound, with our audiences. Of course, as soon as you bung in an electronic program B, back in them days, you haven't got a live offering of at all. Do you know what I mean? In a way, it then created a bit of a division between our recorded profile and our performance profile. We were still getting big audiences and being booked around the country with, you know, colleges, yeah, universities and festivals. But then we produced a record that was a bit of a chin scratcher.
But we've never really done a lot of the records live. I mean, Reburial, I think, is the one that was...
We've just been playing today.
We're going to be playing at the Ska Festival on Sunday.
Which is a cover. It's an old tune. I mean, I suppose the other thing about that, I mean, you know, the difference between the two records is that when, you know, Gaz's idea about recording, and he had, who's that DJ's son? Doing the producing.
Damien Corner was...
Called Damien Corner, yes.
Yeah, so Alexis Corner's son.
But the idea was pretty much to record everything as live as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So I think...
Yeah, he wanted to reproduce Studio One. He wanted a mic in the middle and everyone standing around.
Yeah, but we weren't quite up to that.
Yeah, well, and he wasn't Cox and Dodd, to be honest.
And we weren't Scatterlight.
But, you know,
but that was the idea.
Worth a try.
Yeah. And, you know, and actually, I mean, one of the things about, I mean, again, with Laurel, I mean, my recollection, I might have got this wrong, but I mean, I think, you know, Man About You was pretty much put together in the studio very quickly. I mean, you know, Laurel had a tune. And Laurel could do that. He was very good at, you know, he would play the piano, he would sing, and he'd say, it goes like this, guys, and, you know, bung, 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 and it was pretty much a couple of takes, wasn't it? And that was...
Well, that's one. It's a long time I've been watching.
Yeah,
you. That's the one that was a jam, and then Gaz releases it.
Yeah, that didn't.
We were just testing it out, and it goes on the record.
And I remember thinking, like, this is dragging on. So I start playing all the wrong notes, which is a good way to get a song to stop. That's actually released on the record. You can hear me going.
So this the kind of the final period of the band. I mean, you did Spider Johnson sang on with you for a little bit, like Do the Jerks, probably the most known song from that era, right?
He's back with us now, and we've
been with him today.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So he's part of the...
Reunion.
Revived version of the band, yeah.
Yeah, because he's the singer that's still alive.
Well, and Spider has a lot of, you know, he has a lot of pedigree as well. He worked with Lee Perry. I mean, he can drum, he can play the keyboards, the guitar, you know, and write songs. So he's a talent, you know, and it's great, great. And he's fun live, a little bit unpredictable.
Before you guys broke up, you guys came to the U.S. one time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like 89 or 88 or something like that?
89.
They broke the band. You guys broke us. The States.
Yeah, I was going to say, I heard that you guys didn't have a great time in the U.S. What was the tour like?
No, we did.
We had a brilliant time.
We had a
great time. It was a very badly organized tour from, I don't know, Gerald. You probably know Gerald, too, from Long Beach.
Yeah.
God bless him.
Yeah,
it was great. But we didn't
have any accommodation.
We had no accommodation.
Let's
Go Bowling floors.
I mean, we've been with Dave Weens from Let's Go Bowling, who I know you've spoken to before.
Yeah,
we were with him tonight, and he just reminds us of So we arrived there. There was two vans for the, I think one van had broken down. Anyway, they had to go all the way across the country in a van without any seats. Because we were old fogies, we were 29, 28 and 29 years old, they felt sorry for us, so they let us have the van with the seats in. They had to lie there in a van going, oh, yeah, you're playing Thursday night, you're in CBGBs. Yeah, that's in New York. Saturday night, you're in somewhere, San Diego. And
oh, my God.
And that was literally what it was. It was a two-day gap from...
just the most insane routing possible.
In a van without any seats. Can you imagine?
I did a whole tour in UK and Europe in a van with no seats, and we all just sat on top of the gear. And it was awful. But it was fun.
Please not again.
I'm quite small in stature and I've been put in the boot of a car occasionally. Like, so I didn't know that about Let's Go Bowling, but they were stars, you know. So it's really lovely to have Dave Weens playing guitar for us, because he's not just a guitarist, he's so musical. We were persuading him to play trombone. He's going to get his bone.
We play two of Dave's tunes now as well, Route 69.
Oh, yeah.
He wrote one for us, Eastern Special.
Yeah.
Kind of to complement Western Special.
Yeah, we had a great time in America. The Let's Go Bowling were fantastic. Again, it was that embarrassing sound check moment where you go, oh my God, they're proper musicians.
Did all the US shows were with Let's Go Bowling?
And the Toasters.
Spider Johnson was our singer throughout. Yeah, that was always Spider.
Mm-hmm.
We could play with the Toasters.
It was great. You know, a swathe of Canada. We did Boston. We did New York. We did California. Yeah, we really covered a lot. So for us, as you know, it's a bit of a dream to do an American tour. I don't know if you've seen Spinal Tap, but we were brought up on the film Spinal Tap,
which is the
legend of
Hello Cleveland.
So we got to do that, and it was brilliant.
Because the San Diego gig, we got there, and it was like one man and his dog in a Mexican restaurant in a bar. And the other thing about CBG, because it was the one venue that it was legendary. You know, CBGB is really special, and we got to New York, and I have to say, I was a little bit drunk the night before, and everybody else went sightseeing. So I went to sleep in the van while everybody went to look at Times Square and stuff. So, you know, I got up finally from my nap, and in CBGB's, because, you know, they used to do matinees and everything, so they had a very quick turnover. So, you know, they wouldn't muck about with the sound check. You were either there or you weren't. So I was the only person there at the sound check. So I went through everything. I, you know, hit the drums. I played on all the different microphones and then that was it. And so we played. It was a great gig. Get in the van and drive from New York to San Diego. And somebody had taken a tape at the desk. And I listened to it. And listened to it more, and I thought my mic wasn't on. So I played at CBGB's, but no fucker heard me.
But if it falls in the wood and nobody hears it.
So there you go. It's the Buddhist conundrum, isn't it? Or
set up everybody else's mics, and yours got left out.
I had read that at your CBGB show, members of Bad Brains were in the audience. Is that something that you recall?
No, slackers. I heard.
Slackers, where they saw you guys play?
Yeah, they did. What's the main man from the Slackers?
Vic or Dave?
Yeah, Vic. Richie. Yeah, he told me he was there, and he was, I'm not going to say it. He just said, it encouraged him to do a similar thing. A ska band.
He was inspired.
He was inspired by the fact we were bunch.
America broke up, Potato Five, but it's spawned the Slackers.
Yeah. Vic told me that probably about 10 years ago, and I was like really impressed, like, because they're a fantastic band.
Yeah.
And then I saw him again a couple of years ago, and I said, oh, do you remember me? I'm Simon from Potato Five. And I said to him,
who?
Yeah, I remember his life, but I said, yeah, you told me about how you came to see us at CBGBs. And he said, did I?
Classic Vic.
Impressive story was now. Well, he did tell me it once, so he was inspired.
We'll take it. Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever. There we are, Potato 5. If you want more Potato 5, check it out over on the Patreon. What other bands are a word and then a number? How about Link 80?
Yeah.
How about Adequate 7? How about Blink 182?
Blink 182.
Oh, yeah. Heard of them, too. What about MEV30?
Is that really a word? I don't know if that one counts.
I mean, moo, right? Moo's a word.
Moo.
Moo.
Moo. 330. We never got to ask them why they're Potato 5.
I never want to ask that question. What does your band name mean? This was one instance where it probably would have been worthwhile to ask.
Well, we had 5 potatoes one day. Who knows? We'll never know because I'm never going to look it up. We had a chance to ask them and that we didn't take it, so I will never, ever find out. So if you know the answer, don't tell me. I don't want to know.
Ska secrets. Hey, folks. Once a month, our Patreon subscribers get a brand new bonus episode. These bonus episodes are completely different from our usual content. Here's a sample of the conversation we have waiting for you on our Patreon this month.
So over the life of the podcast, who continues to be like any white whales that you haven't gotten a chance to talk to yet, or maybe somebody that turned you down that you really wish they said yes?
I don't really get turned down so much as no replies. I honestly would still love to get anyone from No Doubt to come on the podcast. I've actually really been after Eric Stefani. That's kind of like... that's the member I'd really like because he was the one that started the band. He was the one that envisioned the band, and he was pretty much the leader of the band up until the point he quit, which was partway through Tragic Kingdom. And he was the ska guy. You know, he was all about ska. So he's a big one. Eric Andre. Why not Eric Idle? I don't know. Let's have him come on too.
To get access to this episode and all of our exclusive backer content, go sign up for our Patreon today. That's patreon.com/indefenseofska. Ska now, more than ever.
Plan on flying? In order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a real ID. Learn how to get your real ID today at tsa.gov/real ID or visit your local DMV.